This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie Bohemian Rhapsody stars my guest, Rami Malek, as Freddie Mercury, the lead singer and songwriter of Queen. The title of the film comes from the title of one of their most famous songs.
Mama just killed a man, put a gun against his head, pulled my trigger, now he's dead.
Queen's biggest hits were in the 70s and early 80s, like Bohemian Rhapsody, We Will Rock You, We Are the Champions, and Another One Bites the Dust. But those records have endured beyond their time on the charts. We Will Rock You and We Are the Champions became popular chants at stadium sports events. Freddie Mercury was a very theatrical performer with a big personality. He died of complications related to AIDS in 1991. Rami Malek's performance as Freddie Mercury is a big contrast to his starring role in the TV series Mr. Robot as a withdrawn hacker with social anxiety disorder. Let's start with a scene from Bohemian Rhapsody. It's 1975, and Freddie Mercury and the members of Queen are in the office of a record executive, played by Mike Myers, talking about the record they're about to release. Freddie Mercury speaks first.
We call the album A Night at the Opera.
Are you aware that no one actually likes opera?
I like opera.
Do you?
I do.
No, don't misunderstand, darling. It's a rock and roll record with the scale of opera, the pathos of Greek tragedy, the wit of Shakespeare, the unbridled joy of musical theatre. It's a musical experience.
Yeah.
Rather than just another record. Something for everyone, something... Something that will make people feel belongs to them. We're mixed genres, we're cross boundaries, we're speaking bloody tongues if we want to.
Rami Malek, welcome to Fresh Air. It's so much fun to watch you as Freddie Mercury. How did you get the part of Freddie Mercury? Did you ask to audition or were you invited?
I was invited, which is, feels like a very rare thing, especially when you're auditioning for someone as magnificent and iconic as Freddie Mercury. I was shooting Mr. Robot, and the producers, Graham King and Dennis O'Sullivan, called me out to Los Angeles, and I knew what the meeting was about, so I started watching as much archival footage as possible, sat down in their office, and about 5-6 hours later, I left that office being told that I had the job, something that I did not quite believe driving back home, but I guess as it panned out, I did.
Was singing part of your audition?
It ended up being part of that audition. I warned them I was not a singer. I told them I don't play the piano. What I do when I'm out on a dance floor could be considered something having to do with rhythm, but probably not. I ended up flying myself out to London because I wanted to be prepared. It was never officially greenlit yet at this point, and I started practicing everything, singing, piano. I started working with a movement coach because I knew that one day we were going to do a proof of concept, which means they were going to take me to Abbey Road and film me singing as Freddie, and they had a camera on me as well, so they wanted to see my physical interpretation as well. So I had to sing to prove that at some point in the future, whatever I was doing would sync up to the way Freddie sang. Eventually, I don't think anybody really wanted to hear my voice as much as they would love to hear Mr. Mercury's.
Yeah, all the music credits in the movie, you know, at the end of the credits are attributed to Queen. So you sang as you were filming, but the music that we're hearing is actually Freddie Mercury and Queen?
It's actually an amalgamation. I will say the large majority of it is Freddie Mercury. I went out every day and sang at the top of my lungs because that's the only way to match what he's doing. He's giving everything 110% always. And in order to sync it up properly, to use bits of my voice in the beginning, it will lead in with my voice and then pick up for the majority using Freddie Mercury's voice. And, you know, tops and tails, as you call it. And what I quickly realized was no one can sing like Freddie Mercury, and nor can I. It's very difficult to get my voice up to those high notes. And at some point, my voice breaks, and it breaks pretty quickly when I'm trying to ascend what Freddie Mercury can do.
There's actually a scene where you're at the piano singing a sketch of Bohemian Rhapsody, and your voice breaks. Is any of that you?
Yes, some of that is actually me. We have an incredible sound engineer named Paul Massey on there who found ways to, I think, deceive all of us. But yeah, there are parts that are me. I think the parts that break, yes, that would be considered Rami Malek.
Should we just hear that bit?
Sure.
Okay, let us know if you can tell which part is you. Okay.
You got it.
So this is a scene from the movie Bohemian Rhapsody, where Rami Malek as Freddie Mercury is at the piano in his living room singing Bohemian Rhapsody. Okay, so the final note, his or yours, voice breaks. What are we hearing?
Gosh, the majority of that is obviously Freddie Mercury, but somehow they've found a way to put me in there, and I can't, I really can't tell you. It feels so seamless to me, and that's, I think, one of the greatest aspects of this film is even I watch it, and I cannot tell. Now, I just want to reiterate that the majority of this, I mean, so much of it is Freddie's voice, and I never want to ever step in and pretend that I lent myself to so much of this.
So now that you've taken singing lessons, are you more comfortable singing?
No. I say I'm more comfortable dancing and more comfortable being on stage. I enjoy the piano now. I find it meditative. At one point, I play it upside down in the film, and I thought, oh, of all the challenges you're giving me, here comes page 20, and the stage directions say, now Freddie plays Bohemian Rhapsody upside down, and I thought, come on, give a guy a break.
Did you not play at all when you started?
No, I'd never played a piano, never touched a piano. I had to learn the guitar as well for a crazy little thing called Love, which didn't make it into the film. But everything was, it was like going to a conservatory of music every day. I mean, 1 hour, 2 hours spent singing, 2 hours at piano, 4 hours in movement and choreography. It was fascinating. It felt like going back to school.
So what can you play on your own now?
Only Bohemian Rhapsody, and we are the champions.
Okay.
I noodle every once in a while. So I'll call those original works.
You were playing the very confident Freddie Mercury, so you had to summon up that confidence for the performance. You had to portray confidence. I don't know how confident you are as Rami Malek, but did you become more confident embracing your Rami Malek self after having embraced Freddie Mercury's confidence?
There was a moment where I stepped on stage in a sequin leotard and that leaves nothing to the imagination. And at one point I said, listen, if you're going to play a man who rocked this thing out like nobody's business and made everything his own and spontaneously combusted in the most magnificent way on stage. You better own this. And I'll tell you, by the end of shooting, we came to another concert sequence, and I asked Julian Day, the costume designer, I said, you know the sequin leotard? He said, yes. I said, do you think you can make that for me in ruby red? and he laughed, and he looked at me and said, well, we've come a long way, haven't we?
Another thing we should mention is your teeth. He had, what, four extra teeth in his upper mouth? And he had, very buck teeth as a result. And so you had fake teeth that you used, made for you by a famous, like, Hollywood prosthetic teeth designer. What was it like for you to wear them? Like, how did it change your feeling of your mouth and your ability to talk and sing? Because, like, not only did you have to sing, you know, for the performance, even though they weren't necessarily going to use your voice, you still had to sing. And so you're doing something you're not used to doing, singing, and you're doing it with teeth that aren't even yours.
Yes, the teeth were difficult to get used to in the beginning. Initially, I put them in my mouth a year prior to shooting and immediately felt insecure. I felt like I was on my back foot in a way. I didn't feel like myself, which did help me quite a bit, but it was a feeling of insecurity that I had to cover them up as well. And I'd been watching so much footage of him. You see him covering up his teeth so often that I thought, how am I ever going to do that? Well, as soon as those teeth went in, it was second nature. I found myself covering them up so often. My lips would dry up, so I would find myself licking my lips as he did. But another thing happened. I started to compensate physically by holding my posture better, elongating my body, sitting up very straight, and that's something you also see him do. And I don't know if that was something that affected him or he was born with the elegance that he has, but it did give me a way into understanding a little bit more about him. His name is originally Farouk Bulsara, and he wasn't even called that as a kid. A very strong set of buck teeth, and most of the kids in school called him Bucky. So you see this young man who travels from Zanzibar and goes to a boarding school called St. Peter's in India. He's travels there on a ship. He feels very, I think, removed and isolated. And when he comes back to Zanzibar, his country is in the midst of a revolution. They have to immigrate to London. And he's a young man at that point, feels like a fish out of water, in the 1970s, trying to identify himself sexually as well. I mean, so much stands in the way of this man becoming who he is. And what I discovered was there is something burning inside of him, this dream that he wants to see realized, this music that is so vibrant and yearning to exist outside of him. And everything stands in his way. But when he gets out on a stage, he holds everyone's attention and says, hey, I may have been an outcast and a misfit, and I may feel like I don't belong, but here on this stage, we belong together. I had to demystify him somehow. And the way to do that was looking at his background. I mean, I thought to myself, here's a young man immigrated to a country, defied all obstacles to do what he loved. And that was one thing that I could understand. Not to compare myself to him in any way, shape, or form, but I am a first-generation American. My family came from Egypt and sought a better life for their children in the U.S. And, you know, obviously, like so many people, they would have loved for us to be doctors and lawyers. My sister is a doctor, so she fulfilled that aspect. But it was very difficult to convince anyone that I wanted to do this and that I could do this.
Did you feel like you were going to be letting them down if you failed, that they came here? You know, I don't know if you were already born when they came here, but still, they probably knew they'd be having, you know, children or more children, and often with immigrants, the idea is it's for the children. So if you failed as an actor, would you have been letting them down? Did you feel guilty for even trying for an acting career?
It's a good question. Yeah, I did feel a bit guilty. And the only way to compensate for that was just to give it my all. There was one moment I was in my apartment that we were living in. There's four of us in a two-bedroom apartment. And I would wake up early. I was sleeping in the living room at that point, and I had a stack of manila envelopes, and every morning I would get up and put my headshot and resume in the manila envelopes. And I remember my father one day standing next to my mom saying, "You have a very tenacious son." And I don't think that he knows that I heard him, but I heard that, and it gave me that extra boost I needed to just keep going. And I would take those manila envelopes. I was delivering pizza. I would put them, glue them or tape them to every pizza box I would send out. I would keep them behind the register of the fast food restaurant I would be working at. And if anyone even producerial came in, they were getting a headshot and resume in their to-go bag.
Did you deliver pizzas to, like, famous producers or directors?
I did get an audition out of it once.
And seriously? Really?
I did, yeah. I did. It was for a commercial. And I've still kept in touch with that person who gave me the audition.
Did you get the commercial?
I did not.
What was it for?
No, I did. It was for M&M's.
Wow.
I will tell you this. Yeah. One day, I did get a call. I got a call from Mara Casey, who was a casting director for the Gilmore Girls, and she asked to speak with Rami Malek's agent, and I said, "Speaking." And she said, "Well, can I talk to about Rami Malek coming in and for a role on the Gilmore Girls?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "And who am I speaking with?" I said, "This is he." And she said, you don't have an agent, do you?" And I go, "No, but we can work on that." And she started laughing, and she said, "Well, are you SAG? Are you part of the Screen Actors Guild?" And I said, "As of yet, no, but that's something else we can work on as well." And she kept laughing, and she's like, "Listen, you're cute. Call me when you get a representation." And I said, "Listen, we're doing all right. We're having a good time. I see that the scene has only three lines. I mean, how about giving a guy a break? And if you're laughing now, chances are I might have you laughing in the room." And she took a few seconds and she said, "You know what, kid, come on in." I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. And I went in on that day. And later on that night, I had a callback for that show. And in between that, one of these manila envelopes that I had been stuffing, sending to every agent in Los Angeles, happened to call me in between the audition and the callback, and the confluence of the things that happened on that day still defy me to have any explanation for them, but it was a very profoundly successful day.
So you got the Gilmore Girls part, right?
I got the part the next day.
So your parents are Coptic Christians who emigrated from Egypt. Most Americans don't know anything about Coptic Christians. Were there other children of immigrants in your neighborhood? Did you live in a Coptic community in L.A.?
I went to Coptic church as a child, and that's about a 3 to 4 hour service, which was in a language I didn't understand. I speak and understand Arabic, but there's a Coptic language that was very foreign to me. I remember the smell of incense being overpowering. I remember sitting with the men on one side and seeing the women sit on the other side, and understanding that this was a world that was very foreign to the second I exited and was in, living in the San Fernando Valley, surrounded by such a diverse culture. We grew up surrounded by a Latin community, a Filipino community, African Americans, everything, Asians. There was everything around me. And so I felt diversity, but then there was also this feeling of a world that I was estranged from in this Coptic community that my parents were very involved in. Also went to Catholic school at one point, so I couldn't quite wrap my head around everything that was happening so quickly to me in terms of the world I lived in and the faith I was, I won't say imposed upon me, but something that...
Born into? You know,
born into, yes.
Did you have a hard time explaining to your fellow students in Catholic school that you weren't Catholic?
That's a very good question. Yes, I did. I didn't know how to explain that when it came time to do confession, I wasn't going to be participating in that. I had a lot of explaining to do, I felt, as a kid. You know, I was born here, but my brother and I really didn't speak English till about 4 or 5. So it was quite difficult to assimilate. I mean, my name seems very easy to pronounce this day and age. Not for everybody, but at that time, for the first 10 years of my life, no one pronounced my name as Rami. So it was very difficult, I think, forming a sense of identity, and perhaps that's why I gravitated to creating so many of my own in my own private moments of creating characters as a kid.
Did people think your name was Rami?
They thought it rhymed with Sammy, so Sammy and Rami.
Oh, because your brother's Sammy.
Correct, and it only took me till high school where I found the confidence to tell everybody, no, my name is Rami.
Oh, so you were known as Rami for years?
Yeah, it's a very upsetting thing to think about, that I didn't have the confidence to correct anyone at that point.
Rami Malek, it's really been so great to talk with you. Thank you so much. Thank you for your performances.
It's been an absolute pleasure. I don't usually share this much of myself, but I figured what better place to do it than on NPR with you, Terry. Thank you very much.
Rami Malek stars in the new film Bohemian Rhapsody as Freddie Mercury. He also stars in the USA Network series Mr. Robot. The fourth and final season is scheduled for next year. Publishers Weekly recently announced its 10 best books of 2018, and one of the titles on the list is Insurrecto, a new novel by Gina Apostol, who was born in the Philippines. The book uses the meeting of two women, one American, one Filipino, to explore the entwined histories of their two countries. Our critic at large, John Power, says the novel is as revelatory as it is entertaining.
Ever since I was young, I've loved stories set in the far-flung reaches of the West's many empires. From the British Raj of A Passage to India to the surreal Vietnam of Apocalypse Now. I still love them, though I now realize that they usually look at other cultures from the vantage point of outsiders, even intruders. That's why these days I seek out books and movies that show how the world appears from the other side of the colonial looking glass. One of the most original ones I've found is Insurrecto, a dizzying new novel by Gina Apostol, who was born in the Philippines but now lives in the U.S. Beginning in a present-day Manila, overseen by thuggish President Duterte, this witty, sneakily revelatory book dives into something that most Americans know virtually nothing about: the tortuous relationship between the United States and the Philippines, which America colonized for 50 years after claiming to liberate it from Spain in the late 19th century. The story starts when our heroine, Meg Salin, a Filipino translator and mystery writer, goes to Manila's Muhammad Ali Mall, yes, that's a real place, to meet Kiara Brasi. She's a fashionable American filmmaker whose father, Shades of Sofia Coppola, shot a funky Vietnam War picture in the Philippines. Although Meg Salin doesn't particularly like Kiara, who we're told has resting celebrity face, she agrees to help with her new script. She even accompanies her on a road trip through the countryside to the town of Balangiga, the site of a dark episode during the Philippine-American War that led to colonization. So far, so straightforward. But after Magsaline reads Kiara's script, she begins writing one of her own. Soon, we're reading two rival versions of scripts. One about a Daisy Buchanan-ish white American war photographer in the Philippines. The other about a Filipino schoolteacher who's had an affair with Kiara's dad. Before we know it, reality and fiction are cross-pollinating. There are stories about telling stories. Every character seems to have a double. And we start wondering why the chapter numbers are appearing in the wrong order. Now, I must admit that Insurrecto does require readers to cope with a few moments of disorientation. But let me assure you that the novel goes down easily and becomes clearer by the end. For Apostol is no mystifier or arid avant-gardist. Rather, she's playful like Italo Calvino or Kurt Vonnegut. She dishes up funny riffs on everything from the Thrilla in Manila and her countrymen's love of Elvis Presley to what the book terms the Filipino Chekhov rule. If you mention karaoke in the first chapter, somebody has to sing it in the last one. For all its fizzy style, Insurrecto is anchored in the pain of lived history. Magsaline and Kiara's road trip is a way of exploring an episode that I'd never heard of. One that, like the Philippine-American War itself, we haven't so much forgotten as repressed. It happened in Balangiga, where in 1901, with help from a woman insurrecto or revolutionary, Filipino locals attacked occupying American soldiers. In retaliation, U.S. Colonel Jacob Smith, who served with General Custer and was every bit as enlightened, ordered his soldiers to kill everyone over the age of 10. And they did. Estimates of the dead range from 2,000 to 50,000. Insurrecto gives us this barbaric slice of our national history, not through guilty American eyes, but through furiously good-natured Filipino eyes, which hope that we'll grasp two things. That we will never understand the modern Philippines, in all its warmth, humor, and violence, without knowing the story of places like Balangiga. And second, that we can't understand modern America without knowing the stories of what we did in our past. It's Insurrecto's great achievement that it confronts us with dreadful things without ever turning into an accusatory, anti-American screed. You see, Apostle is after more than recrimination. Steeped in the love-hate relationship with American culture that she shares with most Filipinos, she actually seeks to transcend the gap between the two countries. Near the end of the novel, Magsaline's rowdy uncles belt out a famous Elvis song about romantic agony that she terms the soundtrack of her life. "We can't go on together," the uncles sing, "with suspicious minds." And that's what Insurrecto seems to be saying about America and the Philippines. We are bound by history, Apostle tells us, but our relationship can never be truly happy until everyone is honest about who they are and what they've done.
John Powers writes about film and TV for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed Insurrecto by Gina Apostle. Coming up, we talk with immunologist Daniel Davis, author of the new book, The Beautiful Cure, The Revolution in Immunology and What It Means for Your Health. He'll talk about some breakthroughs in our understanding of the immune system that are leading to new treatments. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to talk about one of the great mysteries of the human body, how the immune system works. Why does it sometimes attack healthy tissue, leading to autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and diabetes? And how are scientists harnessing the latest discoveries about the immune system to create new medications to fight cancer, autoimmune conditions, and other diseases? My guest is immunologist Daniel Davis, author of the new book, The Beautiful Cure, The Revolution in Immunology, and What It Means for Your Health. He's a professor of immunology at the University of Manchester in England, where he runs a lab that uses microscopes to learn by watching how immune cells detect and kill diseased cells. He says the immune system is far more powerful than any medication we have devised. Daniel Davis, welcome to Fresh Air. So, you say our body's own remedy, the immune system, is far more powerful than any medicine we've devised. Before we go into details, talking about immunity and autoimmune diseases and vaccines and all that stuff, what is it about our own immune system that makes it more powerful than any medicine?
Well, quite frankly, your body is exposed to an untold number of all different kinds of germs, from bacteria, viruses, fungi that might be out there in the world. And most of the time, your body is able to deal with these germs without you hardly knowing about it.
Whereas there's no medication that could take care of all of that.
Exactly. So the immune system has to be able to react essentially to germs that haven't even been in the universe before, right? If viruses are changing their nature through mutations, as you're familiar with the idea that there's a different kind of flu coming around every year. And so your body has to be able to deal with viruses and other types of germs that literally haven't ever even existed before. That's how powerful the system really is.
Among the many things that I learned from your book is that the immune system's potency changes at different times of the day. What are the changes?
Yes, so that's a really hot area of research. And I have to say that this is going to come up, I think, many times in an interview like this, where there are some edges where we don't understand everything. But broadly speaking, your immune system unquestionably changes its power, if you like, during different times of day. And on a very rough level, your immune system might be thought of being a bit more powerful during the night. And part of that is down to the activity of a particular hormone, cortisol. But that's only a first approximation. So when I say that your immune system is perhaps a bit more powerful at night, in detail, your immune system really is in a slightly different state in day and night, which of course leads us to interesting ideas for medicine.
Like,
for example, one of the ways we might be able to use this kind of information very specifically would be in vaccination. If vaccines were given at a certain time of day, for example, they may well have a greater benefit. We haven't yet got to the point where there's a clear government or health message to say, you know, you should deliver vaccines early in the morning rather than in the afternoon. But we are exploring that type of idea. And my guess is that in the relatively near future, some of that will turn out to be true, that certain kinds of medicines will work better at certain times of day to fit in with the state of your immune system at that time of day.
So let's talk about the immune system and cancer. If the immune system fights germs like bacteria and viruses, what is its role in fighting cancer?
This is an extremely exciting area for immunologists all over the world. We once thought, in fact, that how could your body fight cancer? What is cancer? Cancer is not usually associated with any particular germ. There are few cases where viruses would cause cancer. But by and large, cancer is just one of your own body's cells that has gone awry and has started multiplying and dividing out of control and giving you cancer. So it really comes from your own body's cells. If your immune system is wired up to tackle things that are not part of the body, like germs, viruses, bacteria, and fungi, how could it deal with something like cancer? But in fact, we did discover that the changes that happen in the body's cells to turn a cell cancerous can actually be picked up by the immune system. Now, why it's become really exciting, that realization, is that that opens up the idea that we could perhaps look at ways of boosting the immune response to tackle cancer even better. And as you'll be aware, the Nobel Prize was given just last month to scientists from Japan and America for a wonderful discovery that directly uses that idea with a very specific discovery.
What was the discovery?
Right. So essentially, when you're infected with the flu virus, the particular cells in your body that fight that flu virus would multiply in number to fight off the flu. But once that flu virus has been eradicated from the body, you don't need all of those cells in the body. You don't need this heightened state of activity specifically for the flu virus when it's already been eradicated from your body. So the immune system has breaks within it to switch itself off after some time. So the big discovery that these scientists made were that there were specific breaks to switch off the immune system after some time. And although I just again presented it to you as the narrative that got us to understand breaks, they didn't discover it like that. They really discovered it by just following their nose to work out what a particular protein molecule did in the immune system and found out that it switched the immune system off and it acted as a break. If there are breaks in the immune system that are coming on when you need a very long-term response in fighting off cancer, that seems like a bad idea. And so they developed drugs or medicines, antibody molecules essentially, that block the breaks from working. So they turn off the switching off signal on the immune system, which allows your immune system to better fight off cancer cells. And so for some patients with some types of cancer, that's been quite revolutionary.
Let's talk about autoimmune diseases. And those are diseases in which something goes wrong with the immune system and it starts attacking healthy tissue. Describe a little bit more what an autoimmune disease is and give us some examples of them.
Okay, so an autoimmune disease is a disease where your immune system has started to attack your body's own healthy cells when obviously it shouldn't. And there are many examples of this, multiple sclerosis, diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis. And there are many difficulties in tackling autoimmune disease. For example, by the time a person has come to a physician with the symptoms of an autoimmune disease, it's very often the case that the disease has been running already for some time. And so it's hard to know, for example, what the triggers for the specific bad situation that's happened in a person. But also, our understanding of how the immune system works has given us some ways in which we can now begin to tackle autoimmune disease.
There are drugs that are being used and drugs that are in the process of being created and theories that might lead to new drugs for the treatment of autoimmune diseases. Give us an example of a drug in use or in the experimental phase that you think is very promising in treating autoimmune disease.
Well, one of the most successful drugs, in fact, one of the world's most successful drugs, period, never mind just autoimmune disease, is a particular drug called anti-TNF. And we've spoken a lot already about the complexity of the immune system, the fact that there are so many different kinds of immune cells that they somehow have to work together to give a robust response. So the cells have to interact with each other. And one of the things they do is that they secrete soluble molecules so that one cell will send out a secretion to tell another cell, you know, there's a problem here, we need to be switched on and deal with it. And in fact, one of the scientists, Mark Feldman, was on holiday in Spain. And he was, you know, he often tells me, in fact, that people need to take more holidays because that's where you get the big ideas. And he was thinking that if the immune cells are able to egg each other on with these soluble secretions, then perhaps by blocking those secretions, so stopping an immune cell from egging on another immune cell, if we block that, we might be able to stop the immune system from going overboard and reacting in a way that's causing a problem. And so he, working with a clinician scientist, Tiny Maney, developed a drug called anti-TNF that blocks one of the secretions that come out from an immune cell to egg on another immune cell. We block that, and that essentially switches off the immune system, and that prevents an autoimmune disease like rheumatoid arthritis. And it doesn't work for everyone, but it's a hugely successful drug.
Tell us a little bit more about what you're doing in your lab.
My background is actually in physics. So I came to studying the immune system really through the idea that we would use microscopes to watch how immune cells work. We tag individual proteins inside an immune cell and watch what they do when an immune cell sticks on to another cell. And with that, we start to learn how an immune cell sees diseased cells and then how they would deal with it. Obviously, as a scientist, what's most exciting to me is our most recent discovery. So let me tell you about that.
Sure.
So we've been studying how an immune cell sticks onto a cancer cell, and many labs have been watching how it recognizes the cancer cell and how the immune cell then would kill a cancer cell. And lots of scientists have been working on that across the globe. One of the things that happens when an immune cell sticks to a cancer cell is that after some time, the molecule, the receptor molecules at the surface of your immune cell that see the cancer cell. So you have, you imagine a sphere of your immune cell, and you've got these molecules protruding out from the sphere that latch onto the cancer cell. After some time, those molecules protruding out to latch onto the cancer cell, they get chopped off. They get taken off the immune cell. And people thought, well, that's obviously for the immune cells switching itself off the self for some time. We've spoken just now about the idea that your immune system has to switch off after some time. And so chopping off these receptors probably leads to dampening down the immune response. So that means maybe we could design medicines that stop these receptors being chopped off. Now, one of the things that my lab recently discovered was that in fact, the complete opposite is true. That an immune cell sticks to a cancer cell, it will kill it. Then it will chop off these receptors that were sticking to the cancer cell so that it could detach itself from that cancer cell. And then that very same immune cell could move on to kill another cancer cell. Then it would kill it, detach from it, and then go and kill another cell. So chopping off these proteins that are sticking to the cancer cell is really important to boost your immune response, because it's allowing one immune cell to kill a cancer cell, get off it, go and kill another cell, get off it, go and kill another cell. So this is a process that is helping your immune system. So that is a new avenue for thinking perhaps about a kind of medicine that we're not just talking about helping the immune cell to kill a cancer cell. What about helping it get off that dead cancer cell and then going to kill another one?
So are you cutting that, I forget what it is, off in the lab, or is that something that naturally happens?
So it naturally happens, and people were thinking about preventing that from happening as a way of helping your immune cell fight cancer better. But our research would suggest that it's really important that that happens, and in fact, we want to encourage that to happen. A part of the process which seems very important in how your immune cell can efficiently kill off cancer cells is their ability to not just stick to a cancer cell and kill it, but also to then detach from that cancer cell and go and kill another cancer cell.
It was something that you say in the book, I think you say this at the very end of the book, is that everything about the immune system is counterintuitive. So that must make it hard for you as a scientist studying how the immune system works?
It makes it hard, but I think also it's part of the reason to study the immune system. You know, we've spoken a lot about how studying the immune system leads us to new medicines, and that is top priority. Everyone agrees we got to do that. But also, as I try to suggest in the way we're talking about it, the immune system is unbelievably wonderful. And the fact that so much of it is counterintuitive. You know, we have to discover what we are. It's not self-evident as to how our body is able to fight off an untold number of germs, including those that have never existed in the universe. We have to dig into the details and discover what we are. And some of that is really quite surprising and counterintuitive. The concept of an autoimmune disease is utterly counterintuitive. You know, how could you expect that your body is, in some cases, going to turn on itself? You know, that is a counterintuitive idea, which is, of course, hugely important for medicine.
So does that mean you can't go with hunches since everything, you can't go with your intuition since everything about the immune system is counterintuitive?
So I likened the study of the immune system in my book, I likened it to writing a novel, right? So when you read the finished thing, it makes sense. And you think the novelist or the artist or whoever made that movie you just watched, they probably planned it all out. It was all perfect. You know, they got the people, they got the best cast. They wrote the script. The story flowed so seamlessly. Oh, it's a masterpiece, and it was such a good idea, and it obviously was going to turn out like that. And of course, you and I know that it doesn't work like that, that whoever wrote that novel, whoever made that movie, whoever wrote that song were killing themselves to do it. You know, like, I think it's even in one of your earlier interviews that I think it was Leonard Cohen's son mentioned that Leonard Cohen spent 12 years writing Hallelujah.
Yes.
When you listen to Hallelujah, you know, it's a masterpiece, right? Now, I think that the beauty of being a scientist is, you know, I'm not pretending that doing science is like writing Hallelujah, but some aspects of it is the same, that you're digging in and you don't even know where you're going. The story ends up being clear and simple, but it wasn't like that in the outset. The stories are created kind of after the fact, and really when we're in the midst of doing the science, it's just like writing a novel or making a movie, that it's all just messy and you don't really know where it's going, but eventually it pans out.
Well, that reminds me of another sentence that you write in your book, which is, what keeps scientists going is the faith that nature is coherent and that answers exist.
Yes, I think that's really important. That is what keeps us going. That when all this stuff is happening and nothing quite makes sense, what keeps us going is that there will be an answer. That it must be coherent. There must be some way of explaining this strange thing that I'm seeing down the microscope. And if I dig into it enough, it will become clear. Now, one of the important spokes off that, of course, is I've got to choose the right problem, because I could dig into anything. You know, if my computer crashes, is it worth me spending ages trying to work out why it crashed, or should I just turn it off and turn it on again and get it to work again? So it's choosing the things that look like it's worth me digging into or working with my team to dig into. That's the tricky bit about being a scientist, because you never quite know from the outset where what's going to lead to something important.
Daniel Davis, thank you so much for talking with us.
No, thank you so much for having me.
Daniel Davis is the author of the new book, The Beautiful Cure, The Revolution in Immunology and What It Means for Your Health.
That David played and it pleased the Lord.
Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.